Hello and welcome to Technically Legal. This is podcast 46 for April 20th, 2010. I'm Dominic Robbie, and with me today are
Ben Snitkoff
and David Liu.
We're covering three stories today. First, the Infinity Ward Jason West Zampala case, and then we're talking about Adobe versus Apple, and finally we're discussing whether or not you can copyright a tweet. So our first story is Activision Blizzard is countersuing Jason West and Vincent Zampala, countersuing in that I presume Jason West and Vincent Zampala sued them first because Activision Blizzard fired them. Is that correct?
Yes, I believe so, Dominic.
And why did they fire them, Ben?
They were fired because there seems to be a long-running dispute between these people with relation to a subsidiary of Activision called Infinity Ward. And Activision is alleging that West and Zampala tried to steal Infinity Ward away from Activision. So they were fired, and now those two men sued Activision over the firing, and now Activision is suing them over their alleged misdeeds with relation to Infinity Ward.
Infinity Ward, I believe, makes the popular Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2 franchise. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. So that's a pretty lucrative franchise. I think they've made like $1.5 billion in revenue, at least, in the last year or so.
Yeah, and it seems like one of the issues here is that these two developers are, at least should have been on the line for some of the royalties from that game, but their firing was a way to sort of either take those away from them for their misdoing or rob them of their due earnings. So, yeah, so the success of this game does play into it.
Go ahead, Ben.
That kind of royalty problem is actually kind of common. You see it a lot with real estate agents, especially when you're dealing with very large real estate deals like commercial real estate. It's not unusual for somebody to fire a real estate agent right before a deal closes and then make the deal one-on-one with the landlord or the person who owns the property and essentially prevent the real estate agent from getting their fee, their royalty. So, you know, at its core, this is not a very uncommon thing. What is uncommon is the sheer amount of vitriol that we're seeing spewing back and forth between these people and, you know, the allegations and essentially name-calling between these two parties. It seems to have gotten pretty heated.
Electronic Arts, EA, as it's more commonly known, apparently is also somehow involved in this story because apparently Jason West and Vincent Ball allegedly flew to visit Activision's closest competitor, Activision claims in their countersuit. They don't mention who that is, but it's widely speculated that it was EA, and EA weighed in. One of its lawyers or one of its spokesmen said that we don't have time to comment on the many lawsuits Activision files against its employees and creditors, which is snarky in itself. So,
yeah, I believe there was also an allegation that these two people flew to Northern California, which is where EA is headquartered. And it wouldn't at all surprise me if that were the case. You know, California doesn't allow the enforcement of non-compete clauses. So, you know, if these two people wanted to, you know, break off and, you know, either move the company with them with whatever intellectual property they owned or, you know, break off and form a new subsidiary under EA, there's really very little, if nothing, to have stopped them from doing that.
Makes perfect sense. In terms of, I mean, why do you think California doesn't enforce non-competes? That's unusual among states, right? Most states enforce non-compete agreements?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure every state but California enforces these non-competes. I mean, if there are others, they aren't very high profile. I think California's argument behind it is that I mean, the reason why is they wanted to foster development. And a big problem with a non-compete is that, you know, let's say I'm working for a company in Massachusetts and I either resign or get fired from them. I may have a clause in my contract that says, you know, once I leave the company, I can't work for a company that directly competes with, you know, the company I was working for, you know, 2 years, or I can't work for a similar company within a 100-mile radius of where that first company was located. And if you get rid of that, you really foster competition in the area because, you know, I could leave, say, Google and start up a competitor to Google right next door. And as a result, you know, you're going to have at least California hoped, a lot more tech growth. And I think if you compare the, and I don't want to take credit for this argument. This was somebody else's. I forget who. But if you take a look at Silicon Valley and one of the main competitors to Silicon Valley back in the day, which was the 128 corridor in Massachusetts, you saw a lot more tech growth in California than you did in Massachusetts. And some people credit that to the fact that Massachusetts enforced the non-competes while California doesn't. You know, I'm sure there are other factors that go into that, but as far as high-class colleges, we've got, you know, pretty much the same number there and here. You know, we've got MIT and Harvard, and they've got, you know, Berkeley and Stanford, UCLA. There's a compelling argument that not enforcing Caltech those non-competes actually helps competition in the area.
And I'm sure that also the geographic limitations, you know, allows you to have that nice central bunch, and then it's that much easier for competing developers to switch to a different company instead of, you know, having to move 100, 200 miles to some other location. So I'm sure that the area as a whole probably benefits from not having those non-competes as well.
So one thing I want to talk about a bit later is whether Activision Blizzard might be able to use trade secret law to enjoin West and Zampala from any action, because even though there's a non-compete, they might allege some sort of trade secret in terms of developing games or something. I'm not sure what they would allege, but if there's something particularly special about the way Activision Blizzard does, but it seems like West and Zampala were really the heart of the creative force behind the Modern Warfare franchise, and at the heart of this dispute, I guess, is the contract extension that they signed in 2008 after the first Modern Warfare game came out. And allegedly, this extension gives them additional royalties and basically independent operation of Infinity Ward as a studio under Activision Blizzard's umbrella and complete creative control over the Modern Warfare sequels and other parts of the Call of Duty franchise that were sort of focused on Modern Warfare, as it were. Which is a pretty big license in terms of freedom for them. From a purely monetary perspective, it seems to make sense for Activision Blizzard to just fire them, and if they want to get paid, sue, because that if they fail, then they lose money. But if there was no contract, or if the problem is how the court will construe this and whether or not this contract extension will be found as valid or not, because, I mean, obviously, if it is valid, then Activision Blizzard not adhering to it is going to be bad for them, much worse than had they paid out the money in the first place.
Yeah, that's a good point. Going to the trade secret point, if you don't mind, you'd have a tough time. So my guess is Activision owns the code for the game, the copyright and the underlying code there. They would own something along the lines of the all of the graphics that go along with the game. It'd be tough to claim a trade secret on anything, though, unless they're, you know, maybe a trade secret in the way that the in any type of secret. I just don't know what the trade secret claim would be. You know, some part of the engine, right. Maybe. Like the game engine, but even so, that's the kind of thing where if these people want to go someplace else, all they'd have to do is develop a new engine that's not, you know, based
or
on...
Or use another engine that someone else made up, so...
Yeah, it's not like there's a shortage of game engines to build something off of.
David? I don't know a ton about this game, but would a story secret, like, you know, where they were planning to have the characters or the general plot of the game go, would that fall under a trade secret, or is that more of a creative secret?
I mean, Activision would own the derivative rights to these works too, so they wouldn't be able to make a, you know, Call of Duty Modern Warfare Z or something, because, you know, Call of Duty, that trademark is owned by Activision. Modern Warfare, that trademark would also be owned by Activision, so they'd have to be making a new game, you know, if... And once you get down to that level of nuance, like, you know, maybe they were planning for the next game to take place on Mars, and these people go off to a new place and make a first-person shooter that takes place on Mars, it's a tough it'd be a tough argument to make that that was a trade secret or really protected by any intellectual property, because the level of abstraction there, I mean, it's just a location where a game is going to take place. There's not really, there's not a lot there.
Generally with game studios, they own all the intellectual property. So anyway, we will continue following this case as it eventually will end up in court, or unless they settle, in which case we'll cover the settlement. It's more acrimonious than most legal cases of this variety tend to be, or especially more publicly acrimonious. The names that people have called each other in public, and just it usually doesn't get this ugly. So moving on to our next story, another warfare of the modern variety, although into another intellectual warfare, I guess. Adobe versus Apple. In the wake of Apple's iPad not supporting Flash, as the iPad video makes clear by at one point showing a non-functioning Flash element on a page, Apple doesn't support Flash in its products. And Adobe, which is the makers of Flash, among other software, aren't happy about this just because, if the iPad doesn't support Flash and the iPad turns out to be the leading mobile tablet device, that's kind of bad for Adobe because a lot of their company's revenue probably depends on people using Flash, because Flash is one of the focus points for their web development platform. And some people, I guess, have speculated that Adobe and Apple might go to court to resolve these disputes. Ben, could you tell us more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So this was a story. It's one of these unsourced stories. It was from a website called IT World, and the guy basically says, I have a source who says that Adobe is going to be suing Apple about the lack of inclusion of Flash on the iPad and the iPhone. When the story was first sent around, I think the question I posed to the technically legal panel was, name one cause of action that they could bring. Unless there's some sort of contract that was involved between Apple and Adobe about supporting Flash on products, I have absolutely no idea what kind of cause of action they could bring. You know, you can just bring a lawsuit for the sake of bringing a lawsuit, but if you want to win a lawsuit, you have to have some law that was violated or some right that was infringed upon. And I was racking my brain about this, and I could not think of anything. And, you know, a side note, the iPad's usage data has been coming out, and apparently the iPad is taking up, you guys got to brace yourself for this, 0.03% of all internet traffic. So, you know, brace yourselves, guys. This thing is taking the world by storm.
That's a good point, Ben. What cause of action would they sue them for? I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, you can't just bring a lawsuit and say, I don't like you, I want to sue you. Therefore, the court should grant me relief. That's probably a good thing, because our courts are crowded enough as it is. And the iPad really, as you mentioned, isn't that big a deal yet. But the way Apple products seem to go, the first generation kind of is a very tightly designed forerunner, and then the second generation adds a lot of feature set. We saw that with the iPhone. The original iPhone didn't even have third-party apps. And then the 2.0 version added apps, and 3.0 had 3G, and now, I mean, it's significantly more in terms of the mobile browsing market. And it doesn't support Flash either, but I don't like, there doesn't seem to be a cause of action that Adobe can sue unless there's a contract, like you said. What are they going to sue Apple for? Like, you don't like Flash. I mean, is there an antitrust claim here? Like, could they try to do an antitrust claim of some variety?
Yeah, that's the only thing I was the only other thing I was thinking of. But, I mean, you'd have to prove so many things that just aren't the case. One, you'd have to prove market power that Apple... Yeah. Has, I mean, there's no doubt that Apple is a force in the market, but even in the, you know, smartphone business, every major competitor, I think, runs Flash. Well, I guess
BlackBerry doesn't even have full proper HTML rendering, right? It doesn't.
Yeah. Android, which is a huge competitor, does Flash. Yeah. I think Symbian does Flash, and I'm not sure about WebOS off the top of my head.
Right.
But
I think they do Flash as well, but I don't know.
But, I mean, that's not even part of the question. The question is not whether Apple has, you know, how many of competitors do flash. It's how many competitors are there in the market. And even with the tablet market, you've got a bevy of relatively crappy Windows, full Windows tablet computers. You've got things like the Juju and the rumored Android tablet that are, more iPad-like in their feature set and their processing power. But
Basically, Apple doesn't have the requisite market power. Because the way antitrust law works is you have to define the market first, and then you look at how much power that person has in the market that you defined. And if you look at the market as for mobile devices generally, Apple doesn't have that much power. If you look at smartphones, there are a lot of smartphones out there. Like, it's not like the iPhone is 90%. This is not a case of Windows having enormous market power on the desktop as the operating system du jour, basically.
Yeah, and you can bet that Adobe is going to make some sort of cockamamie. Let me back up. If this suit ever gets brought, which I think is speculative at best, Adobe is going to make some sort of argument that the proper market should be smart devices, including mobile phones and tablet computers that run iPhone OS, and it's not a tenable argument. You can't define a market to be the product that you're looking at.
Especially since Apple doesn't license its iPhone OS to anyone else.
Yeah, so. And especially when there are competitors, direct competitors to it. There's an argument that was made about something like a fancy supermarket, like a Whole Foods or a Trader Joe's kind of organic higher-end supermarket. And back a while ago, I think it was Whole Foods merged with Wild Oats or something, and there was an antitrust suit brought by the Department of Justice against Whole Foods for that merger. And their argument was essentially that fancy supermarkets are a market in and of itself. That there's no competition for fancy supermarkets. If Whole Foods buys Wild Oats, then there's just going to be one fancy supermarket. And the district court,
I presume that market. Yeah, they rejected it, I hope.
The district court did, but interestingly enough, the appeals court flipped the district court on that. The appeals court said, I wish I remembered the details of the ruling, but essentially that either the district court had to consider that fact or that it was in fact a market in and of itself for fancy supermarkets. That, if there's only one, people won't go to the fancy organic sections of normal supermarkets, that they just go to these fancy supermarkets. Which I don't particularly believe, but there's only so much you can do when the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit rules.
You can appeal to the Supreme Court.
Petition for cert. But apart from that, no, there's not a whole lot you can do.
That's an important distinction there, that you don't appeal to the Supreme Court, but you petition for cert, which then the court decides whether they want to hear your appeal. So it's not automatic, which means that they might not hear your appeal. So. Important distinction.
So, moving back to the Apple-Adobe dispute, there is this one other interesting wrinkle that I don't know if it's as interesting to the sort of legal half of things, but there's the new iPhone operating system developer kit that was just released, I think, last week.
The iPhone 4.0 SDK.
And I'll just read it for a second. Application. Yes, thank you. It says applications may only use documented APIs in the manner prescribed by Apple and must not use or call any private APIs. Applications must be originally written in Objective-C, C, C++, or JavaScript as executed by the iPhone OS WebKit, blah, 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 blah. And what most people see this as is a way to keep not only Flash off of the iPhone and iPad and the browsers in it, but keep people from writing their apps in Flash and then compiling them so that they can be used as an iApp, and therefore blocking a large segment of developers who are more familiar with Flash and want to get into the market. Instead, this is sort of forcing people to develop on basically just the iPhone platform. And I mean, it's the same sort of thing of, is this antitrustable, or is it just, you know, the fact that they're restricting what they want their platform to be?
Right.
You know, there's this analogy of the closed garden, and, you know, they control the platform. They should have the right, possibly, to determine how it's used, but some people might not like that.
Yeah, that's a good point, Dave. So a little more background is that Adobe had implemented a feature in Flash CS5 that would allow you to basically click a button and compile your Flash application to run on the iPhone. And this was, you know, kind of an end run around the fact that you can't run Flash on the iPhone. And Apple wasn't a big fan of that, largely because if you're writing it in Flash, chances are you're not going to be following any sort of, you know, Apple interface guidelines. You're not going to be, I mean, you're not going to be using any of the native APIs. It's not going to feel very Apple-like, and Apple can't do anything to ensure that, you know, stuff doesn't break along the way. And one of Apple's big concerns is stability. And if you're writing something in, you know, Flash, and then you're relying on Adobe's frameworks to make it run on iPhone OS, there's a whole lot of stability issues that Apple just can't account for. You know, basically the entire Adobe compatibility layer there. Going to the question of whether or not you can sue, again, I don't really see what the cause of action would be. Apple has these software developer kits. You can choose to develop for iPhone 4.0. And, you know, have to abide by this, or you can continue to develop for 3.2, which will only be, you know, useful until the summertime. And, you know, if you develop for 3.2, you don't have to go by these guidelines. You can stick with the old license agreement. Dominic, do you have any thoughts as to how they could get around that and, you know, find some way to sue based on that theory, as opposed to just the fact that Apple doesn't include Flash on the iPhone and iPad?
The SDK theory? I guess I don't see the cause of action there either. I mean, it's their SDK. It's their platform. They set the rules. If you don't want to play by them, that's too bad for you. So no, I don't see a way around it.
One thing that I think a lot of people in the tech community were talking about is the fact that it's very odd to prescribe exactly how the code should be written. I mean, if Apple wants to restrict how things are used on the iPhone, or, you know, what is used on the iPhone, that makes it, you know, people might not like that, but that kind of makes sense. Having restrictions on how that code is developed, the fact that it must be originally written in one of these languages, that makes it a bit trickier in just the sense that it's not only prescribing the content, but the process of by which you create that content. And I don't know if there's an interesting legal point there, but it's a very odd position to take, I think.
Yeah, it's
definitely
kinda
a
like,
unique distinction.
Right, it's kind of like saying that you have to use a certain brand of pots to cook a certain meal. I agree that it's a strange restriction to put on something. But
you can only write your Supreme Court briefs in Microsoft Word.
Right. Yeah. I when you put it that way, it's an interesting restriction that I don't think I'd tolerate many other places, but I do hear, probably only because I love Apple Computer and everything that they do, and sometimes I just stare deeply into their eyes and lose myself.
Okay.
But then again, there are all these other situations where you have, you know, restrictive websites that say, you know, oh, you can only fill out this form if you're using Internet Explorer 5.0 or some wonderful browser like that. But
right. Going back to the antitrust argument for a second, I don't think this is a winner, but at least I could see a tying argument that Apple, you know, charges people $99 to develop, to, you know, get the right to develop on the iPhone, but they're leveraging their position by making iPhones and, you know, being the gateway into making people use Xcode over other integrated developer environments or other things like the Flash CS5 to iPhone compiler. That is at least a colorable claim. I don't particularly think it's a winner, but you may survive a 12b6 there, you know, a motion to dismiss.
You probably won't prevail in the end. Finally, to close out, I mean, there is a reason Apple does have that, as Ben already pointed out, in the SDK they want that restriction because they want to force people to develop afresh for the iPad and the iPhone. They want people to not port, they want people to start over and write for the iPhone and the iPad itself, take advantage of the unique interface guidelines that Apple enforces and just make the software really work well with the device. They did this with the original Macintosh, actually. They didn't include arrow keys in the first version of the Mac in 1985 because a lot of applications back then used arrow keys as their primary navigational method, and by not including arrow keys on the keyboard, they forced developers to rewrite software for the Macintosh and then take advantage of the graphical user interface paradigm. And if they had just let people do straight ports using arrow keys, Mac software wouldn't have had the unique flavor that it ended up having. It wouldn't had been take advantage of the wouldn't have taken advantage of the graphical user interface paradigm, and it would have never caught on in that same sort of thing. And I think they're trying to do a similar thing with the iPhone by having this programming language requirement. They don't want people just porting their Flash app over. They want them to start over from scratch and write directly for the iPhone. And in terms of competitive development, I mean, it's a lot more work for developers, but after developers do this work and invest in creating this application for the iPhone, they'll have learned how to write for that platform and will be more likely to write for the platform in the future. So it's some way of kind of a developer loyalty program, if you will. We'll force you to learn to write on our platform because that way you'll have felt like you spent energy learning to write on our platform and will be less likely to write somewhere else because, hey, I went to all the trouble of learning how to write on the iPhone. Why should I develop somewhere else?
Right, that's a great point, and if I can tack on just one thing to that. The other thing that Apple did when they brought out the Macintosh was they included something called the Toolbox, which was, it was in the ROM, and it was a set of APIs that allowed you to easily create a consistent graphical user interface throughout multiple programs. So, you know, Apple, in return for making people redevelop their software, was giving them an easy way to create new windows, an easy way to drag those windows off the screen. You no longer had to have everybody write their own version of that, which wouldn't be consistent from one app to another, you know, even in visual appearance. So, and, you know, there's a similar thing with the iPod, as far as, you know, you get this great set of APIs that are consistent from one app to another. I think David Liu wants to chime in, so we'll go to him.
I'll just say quickly, I think that is a good idea of sort of, you know, creating the same interface, but there's a better way to enforce the interface by specifying what the interface should be as opposed to specifying what language it should be written in and the fact that you should develop specifically for the platform. I think if that is the end goal, it's a kind of roundabout way to get there. It'd be like saying, you know, going back to the Supreme Court example, you have to type it up with Word, not this paragraph has to be here, this paragraph has to be here, just you have to produce it in this way. It seems like a weird argument. A weird way to get to what you really want. But still, it's a good point.
All right, let's move on to our last story, which is more of a discussion than a story, because it's basically, can you copyright a tweet? We came to this idea after, I think, one of us emailed out, I think it was me, I mentioned that I'd been talking with some friends, and they were like, oh yeah, you can't copyright a tweet, and so it's too short. And I was like, well, that doesn't sound like a reason to me, and I did some research, and we emailed back and forth. And so, can you copyright a tweet?
I'd say absolutely. And the reason... okay, so let me narrow that down. Yes, you can, but not every tweet is copyrightable. So some tweets are, but not every tweet is. So to create a copyrightable, something that's copyrightable, you need to fix it in some sort of medium. So typing it into your computer and hitting enter, that's fine. But there also has to be some modicum of originality in it. And this is a very low barrier to set, but saying, I'm in my room right now, there's nothing original about that expression. It's purely descriptive of what I'm doing, and I don't think that's copyrightable. But, you know, certain things are. Dominic or David, do you want to discuss this for a second while I find an awesome example of what's very short but is totally copyrightable?
David Liu, do you have something you want to say? If not, I can...
Well, I think that the argument that tweets are too short to copyright, I mean, you know, I can't say legally what the copyrightable material is, but there's been some interesting sort of contests where people have tried to see how much stuff they can really pack into a tweet. There's a coding website called Stack Overflow, and they actually had a contest to see who could best encode an actual image in the 160 characters that are available in your, or 140 characters in your tweet. And so using all of the possible characters that you can tweet with, including all sorts of extended Chinese and Japanese and Korean characters, there's some pretty nice pictures of, you know, the Mona Lisa encoded in 140 characters. And so, you know, taking that further, it's conceivable that you could create an original work of art in 140 characters that goes beyond, you know, mundane things about your daily life or interesting news articles. And I could totally see, you know, situations where that's copyrightable.
The United States Copyright Office says that copyright law does not protect names, titles, or short phrases or expressions. That seems pretty straightforward. A tweet is a short phrase or expression, so why isn't this an open and shut case that it's a short phrase or expression, so it's not copyrightable?
Because the U.S. Copyright Office doesn't actually say what is and what is not copyrightable. They're merely advisory, you know. A court would look to the statute, which says any original expression in a fixed medium is copyrightable. Take, for example, and this was what I was looking for earlier, it's a short story by Ernest Hemingway, and I'm going to read the story in its entirety because, like I said, it's very short.
For it's sales, story time with Ben.
Yeah. For sale, baby shoes, never worn. And, you know, that inspired a long series of six-word stories. Like a dress removed carelessly, head less so, was a six-word story by Joss Whedon. And, you know, there's a fair amount of creativity. There's actually story. It's not just an idea that's embodied in this, you know. You can really read a lot into just six words. And I think a court would be very reluctant to find that such a thing isn't copyrightable just because it's short. The court would look to whether or not there's an original expression and to whether or not I think it's clear that it's fixed. So really whether or not there's original expression there and whether or not it's just an idea or it's, you know, it's more than an idea. So to clarify that, ideas alone aren't copyrightable. So if I sat down and I wrote down, I have a great story about a Western that takes place in space, and I wrote that before Firefly came out, I can't go sue Joss Whedon because he ripped off my idea for Firefly. What I wrote down on the paper was just an idea for a story. It wasn't a story. It wasn't an original expression. It was just an idea that was on the sheet of paper. That's not copyrightable.
Right. You can't copyright ideas or expressions, but only original works of authorship. Whatever that means. So then if it seems like you might be able to copyright a tweet, why do we see so many internet pundits think that you just can't?
I mean, there is a perhaps cynical argument here that people view Twitter as being a lot more valuable than what it might actually be. And so, you know, not only is the actual act of tweeting not that important, but it's also not copyrightable, despite what people think.
Yeah, interestingly, there have actually been a couple of books that have been published that are just republications of people's tweets, and it's raised some ire, because I think one of the books was properly licensed, where they contacted people and they asked for permission, or they, you know, paid them some small amount as a, you know, license to publish the tweet in the book. But I know a book came out recently involving Merlin Mann's tweets were in it. I don't remember the name of the book off the top of my head, but he was not contacted for permission to put his tweets in this book, and he was not happy about that. You know, it's all nice and well to think that these aren't copyrightable, but, you know, if somebody takes your tweet and republishes it for money when it's not something descriptive, say it was something clever that you thought up, I think you'll be a little more protective of the copyright of a tweet once, you know, a tweet gets stolen from you.
I don't remember what the name of the company was, but there was one company that was selling t-shirts for a while that you could just send them a link to a tweet and they would put it on a t-shirt for you. But then I ran up with some trouble as well because people didn't give permission at first. And so now in order to get the t-shirt, you have to have the original tweet or give permission to have said tweet be on said shirt.
Yeah, I can't remember the name of the company either. I was just Googling it and I couldn't find it. But right now there's an opt-in program. So you go to the website and you click a button and you put in your Twitter name and password and it'll opt you in. And I think you get $1 for every t-shirt that they print with your tweet on it. I've opted in. Sadly, no one has opted to publish any of my tweets, and it hurts me a little bit. Somebody buy a t-shirt with my tweet on it, please.
Twitter, interestingly, in their license agreement, does not claim any copyright in your tweets. So they have a license to perpetually display and republish your tweets. Is that right?
I would certainly hope that they got that right. Otherwise, they're in big trouble.
They're screwed. Yeah. They are screwed, to borrow the words of an Adobe evangelist. Well, that's not exactly the same. But I think he said screw you instead of they are screwed. But yeah, but so they have a license, but they don't copyright the tweet themselves, which means that the copyright remains in you, the author of the tweet.
Yes, which is very good. I like when companies don't claim to own the things that I make but upload to their
what
websites.
About retweets? Like we see a lot of retweets with RT at someone and then their tweet in its entirety. Does that violate copyright law? Do I need to direct message them and say, excuse me, sir, I'd like to retweet your tweet. Could I have your permission to do this?
I mean, that's an interesting question. My guess is that there's an implied license to retweet with as long as there's crediting of where the original tweet came from. I think you'd have a tough time saying that somebody can't retweet you, especially if your Twitter feed is public. But that's
my argument. Do I retweet Ben's most memorable tweet and then make a t-shirt on it without his consent and not give him a dollar as long as it said at Snitty there?
It depends on whether the tweet itself is copyrightable. If Ben's most memorable tweet was brushed my teeth tonight, then yeah, you can probably do that. Of course, you might not be able to, but if it's something purely descriptive, then that's not copyrightable. So,
right. Assuming the tweet was copyrightable, though, I think David Liu and the tweeting t-shirt place would violate whatever copyright I had in it by David Liu retweeting it and then publishing the shirt that is the retweet of my tweet.
Right. Attribution is no defense to violating copyright. It is a defense to what exactly? It's not a defense to willfulness either, because you know that it's not theirs. I mean,
yeah,
plagiarism.
Is it a defense to plagiarism? But that's not against the law, is it?
No, yeah, and it's not really plagiarism if you cite a source.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, I don't think attribution is a defense to anything. I think it's just being kind about your copyright infringement.
Anything else on this question or thought?
No, other than to mention that all tweets are now archived in the Library of Congress, so think about that next time before you tweet something.
All right. David Liu, any last comments or thoughts?
I'm going to go try to think of something memorable to copyright and then tweet it, and then retweet it a couple times.
You could tweet, I'm going to think of something memorable to tweet so I can copyright it. Huh? A meta tweet. And on that cheery, horribly nerdy note, this concludes this episode of Technically Legal. I'm Dominic Rabier.
I'm Ben Snitkoff.
I'm David Liu.
Thank you for listening. Please visit our website at technicallylegal.org. You can subscribe to our podcast and our blog feed there. And if you have any thoughts or comments, feel free to comment on the story itself or email us at podcast@technicallylegal.org. Take care.